Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen today. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. During this hour of the show, we will take your questions about preserving family heirlooms, artifacts, and other treasures, books, artwork, photography, any of those things, quilts, I imagine may be a topic we'll discuss today. We have two experts who are involved in a number of preservation activities here at the University of Illinois. Jennifer Hain-Tepper is the head of conservation for the University Library here at Urbana-Champaign, where she oversees general and rare book, paper, and photographic care and conservation. And Krista D.C. Quinn is the collections manager at the Spurlock Museum, and before that, the World Heritage Museum at the University of Illinois. And as collections manager, she is responsible for artifact preservation, integrated pest management, exhibit design, mounting, installation, a number of things. And they have seen a lot of different situations and can answer a lot of questions about preserving things during this hour of the show. That's what we'll try to do. I will also mention that they are involved in an event this Saturday, which, with full disclosure, I have to say that I'm also involved in. So my objectivity may be seriously in question here. This event is at the Spurlock Museum this Saturday, March 3rd, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. The title is Heirlooms, Artifacts, and Family Treasures, a Preservation Emporium. The idea is you can bring your stuff, of ideally small things. Don't bring in a couch or anything, but bring in, you know, items that you care about, that preserve your family memories, heirlooms, things like that. And there will be a wide range of experts to provide some guidance on how you care for those things. What do you do with this? How do you preserve it? And we can't do certainly any kind of assessment of value, things like that. But anyway, the idea is these things are important, so let's talk about how to preserve them. So that's free and open to the public, and you can feel free to attend. Also, feel free to call in during this hour of the show. The phone number, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Anywhere outside of the 217 area code, use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Your questions about preserving family treasures are welcome during this hour. And Krista, Jennifer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
All right. So this is going to be a very interesting event. Maybe I can ask you to talk a little bit more about that, and then we'll dive in and talk about, you know, sort of preserving family treasures.
Sure. I suppose I can start.
Sure, go.
Basically, this idea sprung from a group here on campus, members of the Asset Preservation Subcommittee of the Cultural Engagement Council here on campus, which represents multiple organizations on campus that represent our cultural institutions. We do work both for campus and trying to educate people on campus how to preserve campus holdings, but this is our first attempt to actually start educating the public and the community about educating them about preservation. And we're trying to reach out as broadly as possible to bring people in from the community. I know people have lots of questions. Krista and I field calls from people weekly with questions they have about artifacts that they hold personally or that other institutions hold, and we're always answering questions. So we thought this would be a great opportunity to bring in a real variety of specialists to be able to address some of those questions and really start to educate the public and raise awareness.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of stuff do you hope people are going to want to talk about, or maybe bring in to, you know, talk with the experts?
Well, we're hoping that they bring in textiles, photographs, books. We also have musical instrument specialists there. We have audiovisual specialists there.
Scott Schwartz from the SUSE Archives.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he's going to be there.
Yeah. And with some instruments.
Very much so.
Yes.
So we're very excited about that. We get to hear some of those. And we have some archaeologists that are going to be there. So if you found anything in your backyard, you could come out, you bring those in. Mm-hmm. We also have some architecture specialists that will be there. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
So we have a variety of different types of experts to answer questions about a variety of different types of materials. So we want you to challenge us, bring in some things.
Right.
Also, photographs, film, things like that, audiovisual materials. I'm going to be involved in a booth there or a table or whatever the heck it's going to be. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I think so. I think it's going to be a really great event. We're also going to have a keynote speaker there, speaking from 1 to 2 o'clock.
Yes.
It's Robert Mazrum, And he'll be speaking on archaeological preservation and the role that preservation plays in archaeological discoveries, I believe. He's supposed to be a very, very good speaker. We're really excited to have him. He just published a book, and that will be from 1 to 2. After that, we have a wide variety of freebies, actually, that we have gotten from various vendors, some really spectacular items that we're going to raffle off for free from everybody who attends. That'll be at 2 o'clock. We've got quilt boxes, which typically run between $40 and $75 a piece. I don't know, Chris, if you know the going price for quilt boxes right now, but they are pricey pieces of material, and we have had these donated to this event. So we're very grateful to some of our donors who have given us materials, but we'll be raffling those off at 2 o'clock.
It's a big challenge, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot. I mean, you know, certainly from the library perspective, you know, the University of Illinois Library's got how many million volumes?
Over 10 million volumes.
Right.
It is a huge and daunting challenge. The library preservation of library materials in our library is endless work because materials obviously are falling apart as quickly as we can repair them. So I have a lot of job security at the library as far as keeping care of our collections. But people who work in preservation, Krista and myself and all the people who are coming to this event, all care very deeply about what they do. I think we all feel like we're really touching the history of not only Illinois, but of the world and helping to preserve that for future generations. So we all really do feel that we're doing something not just for ourselves, but for a larger community. And we care very deeply about what we do. And we're very interested in helping other people understand what we do. I did want to point out the one thing that we didn't mention as far as a specialist that's going to be there on Saturday, too, is we'll actually have someone who's talking about electronic media, so digital photographs and computer files, which is something that typically an event like this, people frequently think of bringing in their old family photographs or their family Bible or their old family quilt, and everybody knows that those are things they need to work towards saving. People aren't thinking right now about needing to save their digital photographs and don't realize how much work it's going to take to preserve digital objects. And so we are going to bring someone in who can actually speak to that and to help people make critical and intelligent decisions about helping to preserve their digital media, which is going to be a real challenge in the coming years. And I know for the library in particular, it's going to be a very big challenge in our coming years as libraries move more and more digital. We'll always have books. I will always have a job helping to work towards the conservation of book and paper materials. But preservation in the library is starting to envelop a much broader spectrum than just books and paper.
Well, just on that issue, the issue of digital preservation, you know, people may think that, well, it's digital, you know, so it can last forever. It's not going to degrade. You can make copies of it and it won't.
Alas, it is not always that easy. It is very easy to copy things over, but when you're talking about millions of digital objects, even just copying them over is a tremendous amount of time. And the reality is that a digital object's lifespan can be very, very limited. We don't think about how quickly technology is changing sometimes. And we say, yeah, a CD can last for 100 years, but how long can you play that CD, even if the CD is still viable? I have a drawer full of 3.5-inch floppies, and I will admit that I'm old enough that most of my undergraduate career is on 5.25-inch floppies.
I have those too. Absolutely right.
And I have no computer anymore that will play either of those, even though the files are still viable. So preservation not only involves being able to make the right choices in the media that you're saving it in, but also having to convert things constantly to new interfaces to be able to continue to access those. A book or paper or quilts, benign neglect is a term that we use in preservation that is kind of, you put something on a shelf and you don't deal with it for 20 years. And if it's a taxidermied squirrel, perhaps some of the fur has fallen out and it's lost a tooth or two. And worst case scenario, you've had an insect infestation and it's eaten some of the fur off the ears. With digital media, benign neglect is no longer an option. And the loss is no longer minor. If you ignore something for 20 years and it's digital, that media is gone. And so this is something that we do need to be thinking about very actively.
Also, people believe that plastics last forever, too, which is actually it's actually not true. So plastics aren't as stable as you believe they would be. So sometimes some of the media that the audiovisual material is placed on isn't necessarily as stable as people believe it is either. So I've had people tell me, well, it's plastic. It'll be around for hundreds of years, kind of like that thing about the Twinkie being around for hundreds of years, that kind of thing. So,
yeah, just preserve it in a Twinkie or something. Yeah. Well, and Krista, as the collections manager at Spurlock Museum, as I mentioned at the start, I mean, you deal with an incredible range of materials.
Yes, we do. We have everything from ancient Roman glass. We have a human mummy. We have teepees, leather and fur materials. We have feathers, cuneiform, ceramic, metal, armor. You name it, kind of in materials, we have it. So we have to know a little bit about every type of preservation here at at our museum. So sometimes it's pretty complicated. Some artifacts don't play nice with other artifacts. They want to be at different temperatures, different relative humidities. Sometimes we have artifacts that affect other ones. So if it's made out of rubber, it actually affects our silver pieces. So those can't be displayed together. So sometimes it's a challenge to deal with the different materials all together.
Mm-hmm. Have you also found, and I think I know the answer to this question, but it's... Go ahead. I'll throw it at you. You're the expert on this. That certain efforts at preservation have created problems that then you have to address down the line.
Exactly. I can bring up something that then Jennifer can talk about. When sellotape came out, it was considered to be – so scotch tape, sellotape was considered to be the most magnificent material ever. And at the time, they thought it's translucent. It can tape things together. And we have sellotape on a lot of our items, and now it's degrading. It's actively degrading the pieces. Sometimes laminating pieces was also considered something that was done and that would preserve the pieces for a long period of time, and now that plastic is degrading. Do you want to talk about those two things?
Oh, sure, because I'll bet you that there aren't that many laminated teepees, but boy, we've got a lot of laminated books. The preservation is a field that really, from a collection-wide standpoint, only started with concerted research back in the 70s or 80s. Before that, people did the best they could, and there was a lot of what we call restoration, which is actually a very different approach where you're trying to make things look new all the time. And that's not what Krista and I do. We try to stabilize materials and keep them from deteriorating further. Starting in the 70s, people really began to try to actively stop the deterioration. And there were some approaches that were very damaging that people thought, with their best intentions, that this was actually helping materials. Lamination was one of those. The Library of Congress actually latched on to lamination as a blessing for their manuscript collection, particularly a music manuscript collection, because music is used quite heavily. The pages were getting quite fragile. Lamination helped to support both sides of the page. It helped keep the patrons from fingerprinting all over the ink. And so they went wholeheartedly into laminating their music collection. Unfortunately, lamination is amazingly destructive over time, and what they hadn't done is known how lamination would age. And this is a fear that even Krista and I have, is you never know what you're doing and how it's going to react over time. We have accelerated aging tests where we modify and try to mimic the process of natural aging by putting things in hot, humid ovens for very specific time periods that are supposed to estimate then 50 years of aging, 100 years of aging. And we can estimate how things are going to deteriorate based on that. But it's no substitute for real-time, real aging. And things do that maybe even we're doing now sometimes may have adverse reactions over time. That said, that's one of the reasons that Krista and I both approach everything with doing the least invasive, least change possible whenever we're looking at stabilizing or repairing something. My greatest fear is that people are going to go out and laminate their personal belongings. Lamination is probably my absolute arch enemy next to acids and paper. Lamination, the problem with lamination, just to clarify, is that all adhesives with scotch tape, with any pressure sensitive adhesive material, is that the reason the adhesive sticks is because it's a liquid. And it maintains a liquid nature. It's a very, very slow moving liquid. But a liquid over time will flow. And so with scotch tape, many people have seen, as scotch tape ages, you'll get a little ring around it of sticky that's oozed out outside of the tape, and it will start to stick to things next to it. And so that's one of the reasons that we always have to remove tape, aside from the discoloration and the other damage that it causes. The liquid inside lamination is contained within that lamination package, but that doesn't stop the adhesive from flowing underneath there and traveling. And some inks on materials are
solvated by that adhesive. So in the case of the unfortunate Library of Congress music collection, red manuscript ink is particularly soluble over time in the adhesive that lamination uses. And they were finding that all of their red manuscript material on some very, very valuable music manuscripts. I don't know the particular composers, but it was of the ilk of Bach or Mozart or Chopin or something like that. They were finding all the ink manuscript writing was beginning to feather and bleed very badly because the ink was solvating into the adhesive and then traveling. Mm-hmm. And so they're getting these giant red feathery streaks where what used to be a very crisp manuscript notation is now just a blur. And so they have been spending thousands of dollars and hours of conservators' times trying to undo lamination. So that's, you know, just an example of why we do not laminate. So we have a lot of other options out there.
Okay. We have a caller to talk with.
Great.
Why don't we include them in our conversation?
Excellent.
And we'll welcome others if you want to join us. Actually, we have a couple callers waiting, and we'll get right to them. Jennifer Hain-Tepper is the head of conservation at the University of Illinois Library here, and Krista D.C. Quinn is the collections manager at the Spurlock Museum, also at the University of Illinois. Your questions on preserving family artifacts, heirlooms, treasures, etc. are welcome. 333-9455. That's around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. First up, someone in Atlanta, Illinois, line number four. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This ought to fit right into being a good question. I have a series of about 18 photographs that I just found in my parents' estate that were thrown, buried in the basement. I have no idea how they got there. Some, they're about 8 inches high, and they fold, some of them, half of them fold out.
Okay.
So they got some kind of muslin or something in the back that allows them to fold.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them fold out to be in excess of like 40 inches.
Wow.
And they look, in all the pictures, there's one motorized car type vehicle that looks to be like about a 1903 or something like that, but it's of a, that's of a large plantation, and it looks like it's a prospectus to sell this plantation. And it was glued into photo album, black photo album. Well, over time, the photo album pages disintegrated, but the pictures remain pretty well intact. So what I did was the remaining black material of the photo album, I cut that off, and the pictures are all, like, really good. You know, I think that opening them and closing them all the time is probably not a good idea. That eventually going to break something and the picture is going to fall apart. But right now, they're all still intact. And I just put them, they were in a little file holder thing. And I just put them back in there. And, you know, that's where they are. So what, you know, they look, they're very interesting. So I want to save them.
Sure.
What should I do?
Well, you've certainly taken the right first step, which is to remove them from that embrittled scrapbook paper backing. Scrapbook paper is inherently a very, very poor quality paper.
The bad thing is that I couldn't take it off the back. So I just trimmed the edges. So it's
that's removing a little bit more of that material than was there originally. So that was the right approach. Where are you storing them right now?
They're just sitting here in the house, still in that same folder that they were in to start with. So
okay. And my last question then before I answer is, with the photographs on the folds, are they actually cut or is the photograph itself actually folding?
They're probably actually cut.
Okay.
So that the, you know, there's actually a space between the photographs where there's muslin, but you know, it's hard to tell because they're really, you know, whether they've broken there from folding or whatever, but they were designed to fold up and fold down. So I got to imagine that they're individual, but they match up just absolutely perfect.
Right. So. Certainly, folding and unfolding them a lot is going to start to put a wear on the two edges that are adjacent to each other. However, it sounds like they were linen-backed, and they probably were meant for some sort of presentation and were meant to fold and unfold. So I'd say that a reasonable amount of folding and unfolding isn't going to cause any great damage. If you start to see any flaking or lifting of what's called the emulsion layer, which is the top image layer of the photograph, then that starts to be cause for concern. But if they're not abrading and you're not seeing any flaking or lifting or creases along the fold, then I think they were probably made with enough clearance that that's safe to fold and unfold. The number one thing you're going to want to do is improve their storage environment. from the age that I'm guessing these are, they're probably silver gelatin photographs. If they're that size, they could be albumin. Do they look kind of brownish in tone, or are they fairly black and white?
I'd say if they're brownish, it's very slightly
okay.
brownish. Now, there is one photograph includes a photographer in the scene also, so they must have had more than one camera, and it's a great big giant box type
mm-hmm.
thing
mm-hmm.
On a tripod, so I don't know what that would tell.
Mm-hmm.
Give you a little hint of it isn't like a modern camera we
sure.
use today.
Sure. They're probably silver gelatin photographs. What I would do is take them out of the storage enclosure that you found them in, because that is almost guaranteedly an acidic storage environment, and you're going to want to replace that with an acid-free storage environment. And there are boxes available through lots of vendors, both online, but even some around the community. Scrapbookers tend to actually buy fairly good quality materials, and you can, if you know what you're looking for, sometimes you can find materials in a scrapbooking shop here. But what I would do is you're going to want to look for acid-free materials, a box that is probably buffered, which means that it actually has a pH above 7, which is going to help to combat the acids that are being produced by that backing paper. If these are particularly important to you, a professional conservator can look at actually removing that backing for you. But I would say getting them out of their immediate storage environment, putting them into a buffered environment, and putting them somewhere cool and dark and dry is all going to help to preserve those for the long term. High humidity, high temperature, and rapid temperature fluctuations are all the enemies of the preservation of anything at all, and photographs are particularly sensitive to that.
Pretty much we want to say that we do not want people storing things in their basements
mm-hmm.
and in their attics. Which is where people tend to store most things and they forget about them. So the first thing you did by taking it out of the basement
mm-hmm.
is one of the best things
yes,
that you can
absolutely.
Do. So no basements, no attics. That's a theme that I usually hear, oh, I found this in the attic or I found it in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
Remove all your precious materials from those places. I know they're excellent, bigger storage areas, but if you want to preserve something, you need to remove it out of those spaces.
Right. A closet in the interior of your house is usually the best place.
Okay. Could somebody tell by looking at those photographs whether they the type of photograph that you mentioned, can you tell from the print what if those are those kind of photographs? Or?
Yes, generally we can.
Okay, mm-hmm. that's something that can be done.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
that would help in dating for sure the type of photograph it was.
We can give you a range. Photographic processes overlap a little bit, but we could definitely give you a range.
Okay.
Okay.
I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks so much. We're actually already at our midpoint. Let me just mention our guests again, and we'll get on to some more callers. Jennifer Hain-Tepper is the head of conservation for the University Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where she oversees general and rare book, paper, and photographic care and conservation. And Krista D.C. Quinn is the collections manager at the Spurlock Museum, and she's responsible for artifact preservation, integrated pest management, exhibit design, mounting, and installation, and she sees a whole heck of a lot of different stuff. And we're taking your questions on preserving same. We actually have, one line open and several people waiting. I'll mention the numbers again. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's go next to an Urbana listener, line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I'd like some information on taking care of wool braided rugs, especially very old ones.
All right. Well, let's talk about that. Where is this wool braided rug right now?
Well, it's not a particular rug. It's my rug braiding teacher in Maine, and she's trying to find old rugs in New England.
I see. Okay. Well, the first thing we want to do, especially with wool, is we want to make sure that they're pest-free, so we want to check them for pests, depending on where you put the wool-braided rug. So, for example, if this is something that's utilitarian, you walk in on it, you're, of course, then going to get any kind of traffic on it. If you want to preserve it, usually most people hang those up. However, insects are very clever creatures, so they usually work from the back to the front, so you don't see them quite often. So if you have something hanging up, anybody has textiles hanging on their walls, you usually have to take them down a couple times a year and really carefully check the backs of them. Especially web-making clothes moths tend to actually move some of the thread into their web so you can't see them. So you really have to get down and look at them and closely inspect them. You want to keep things out of sunlight. We also didn't mm-hmm. talk about that. So any direct sunlight, we want to keep things away from. And when you have these things in your home, you want to be careful not to have things near a fireplace or near vents, because that's where you get a lot of airflow, mm-hmm. which sometimes you could get pollutants in that kind of thing. As far as, is she looking to store them or hang them?
Well, we were hoping to collect some and have them in museums, which means they would be cared for properly if we could get them in, but also some of us are buying old rugs and having them in our homes.
Well, if you're having them in your home, you want to make sure, of course, that you're not in a trafficked area. You want to make sure that when you're hanging them, that you look at the stability of the piece itself so that you're not really you're not pulling against the threads. Also, any type of textile is usually happiest flat. But sometimes people don't have room for that. Sometimes I suggest to people to put these kind of rugs in a guest room that's not frequently populated, but you could still enjoy the piece and it's out somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, thanks so much for the call. Next up, someone in Mattoon, line number two. Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call. I'm trying to find out how to remove mildew from old postcards.
Oh, that's a real challenge. Unfortunately, it's likely mold, actually. If it's one thing Krista taught me, it's that mildew only grows on living things. So actually, despite the fact that we all call it mildew, it's growing
mold
on something that's not alive, it's actually mold.
Yeah.
Mold on paper is a very tenacious problem. What you want to do first is get it into a dry environment. Mold thrives in moist environments, and you could see it spread very quickly if you keep it in any place that has a humidity above 50%. So you want to get it into a very dry environment as soon as possible. That's going to drive the mold into inactivity if it's not already inactive, and that means that while it's still has potential to grow, it is not actively growing. Removing it is fairly difficult. Unfortunately, the stains that's caused by mold on paper are very, very difficult to remove and isn't something that somebody can do easily just at home. It really needs to be done by a professional. What you can do is buy a very soft, like a makeup brush,
yes,
and have a good
like a
quality vacuum attachment, and at least brush them clean into the vacuum, and that will remove a lot of the any of the loose material and at least reduce it down to just the stain. Staining that's in the paper, but that staining would have to be removed by a professional, unfortunately.
I see. So very careful with carefully using a small vac.
You'd want to have the vacuum near just to attract any of the loose material that you're brushing off.
Oh, and I see. You're not actually
touching the vacuum to the object at all. That's far too aggressive. You want to just use the brush to clean the surface,
yeah,
and then have the vacuum there just to attract any of the loose material that you're brushing off. So you're not just stirring it into the air or just moving it around.
Yeah.
You're actually extracting it from the object. And if you have a HEPA vacuum, that is way better to use than just a standard household vacuum, because that's actually going to trap any of the mold spores that you've got.
What kind of vacuum did you say?
HEPA, H-E-P-A. It's a high efficiency particulate air filter. And they're available for a lot of people who have pet allergies or smoke allergies.
Oh, uh-huh.
And it's a higher efficiency filter that actually does not allow mold particles.
How about doing it outdoors?
Pardon me?
Would it be possible to do it outdoors?
It would be if you can do it outdoors. That way, at least any mold that you're spreading is not staying around your house. So, yeah, if you don't have a HEPA vacuum, I would definitely do it in a well-ventilated area or outside.
Yeah, preferably on a warm, dry day.
Yes, and that would be even better. And then it's important that for the rest of time, if these are important postcards to your collection, that you keep these very dry. Because the mold can reactivate if the humidity goes up. So you want to keep them someplace cool and dry.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
No problem.
And it is really important to not put your vacuum directly against your object.
Absolutely.
And so if we go back to that wool rug question, we want to sweep it off gently. What we do at the museum is we also take pantyhose ends and put them on the end of the vacuum.
Yeah, to protect in case you suck anything up accidentally.
Exactly. So it doesn't get sucked into the vacuum. It's very hard and not very fun to retrieve pieces out of a vacuum.
And I think probably we've both had to do that once or twice.
Yes, we have. So.
And it's not fun.
No.
Oh, dear. Well, I have a couple questions I want to try to squeeze in, but I will defer to callers before I get to that. We'll go next to someone in Moultrie County, line number three. Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm really enjoying your program. I've got a letter that was written in 1863.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes.
I've got a letter that was written in 1863 in blue ink and it's fading pretty badly. Is there any way I can restore that to make it so it's legible?
Unfortunately, no. That really borders on what I was talking earlier about the difference between restoration and conservation. And conservation would never go in and try to actually ink over, which is really your only option. That's a restoration. And what happens then is that you're no longer looking at the original artifact. There is no way to bring back the vibrancy of ink once it's faded. What I would recommend is there are a lot of people out there who will make a digital scan of the object, and you can actually then play with the resolution on a scan to actually bring the contrast of that ink back up. But what is important is frequently that ink is fading for one of two reasons. Either the paper that it's on is becoming darker over time, so the contrast between the ink and the paper is minimizing, or the ink itself is fading, which is frequently due to being out in sunlight or exposed to light too much. Is this a piece in a frame or on a wall, or is it in a book or someplace dark?
It's been stored in a family Bible probably for 100 years.
Okay. So it's not light damage then.
No. The paper's still almost pure white.
Uh-huh. And the ink is still fading?
Yes.
Okay. It's possible the ink was very light to begin with, given the age of it. Perhaps a lot of people made their own inks early before the turn of the 20th century, and there wasn't a lot of control over the amount of pigment in inks, and sometimes those inks were very, very light even at the time they were made. So it may be that you're actually seeing as dark as this ink ever was. However, sometimes there is degradation of the coloring particles, especially if it was dye-based ink as opposed to pigment-based ink. And that's something that, again, a cool, dry, dark environment, stabilizing it as much as possible. Generally, if the paper around it looks like it's discoloring or becoming acidic, putting a buffer sheet of good quality buffered permanent paper on either side of the letter will help to protect the letter against possible acid attack from any of the materials that are around it. And a lot of times those older Bibles, unfortunately, aren't on great paper. So that may be a problem as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
No problem.
All right. Thanks and good luck. Let me just mention again our guests during this hour, Focus 580, Jennifer Hain-Tepper. She's head of conservation for the University of Illinois Library. And Krista D.C. Quinn is a collections manager at the Spurlock Museum here at the University of Illinois, talking about heirlooms, artifacts, and family treasures, and taking your questions about how to care and preserve them. And let me mention again that there is a free public event this Saturday. We're calling a preservation emporium. And I say we because I'm involved in it as well. So just to get that clear and on the table, there will be a wide range of people available, experts in a whole bunch of different areas of preservation, available to talk to anyone if you want to come by and bring some small items, ideally small items, if you want to do that. And we'll try to give you some good advice. And that's Saturday, 11 to 3 at the Spurlock Museum on the campus of the University of Illinois. The address, 600 South Gregory Street in Urbana. And it's just east of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. So you should feel free to attend that. And we'll continue here taking some more calls from people. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Jennifer Temper, I have an 1848 songster that not even the Library of Congress knows about.
Wow.
Well, this is what I understand. It's the Negro American songster.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've talked to Alan Jabor about this. He hasn't seen it. Neither has Charlie Wolf. And the binding's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got all the boards. It's got all the pages.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the paper is foxed.
Okay.
Pretty seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, I need to reproduce this.
Okay.
It's got to go onto a copy stand.
Okay.
And what kind of material do you push it down with so that the seams aren't...
You're not getting that curvature along the gutter?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Is the printing or is there marginalia that is far into the gutter so that curvature is something that you really need to be concerned about? Or would you pull a fairly good image off of it without putting undue stress on the gutter?
Well, it's a readable image, but it still has the curvature.
Mm-hmm. And what is the purpose of making the reproduction?
For sale, my friend.
Aha. Okay, so you're obviously interested in getting a very good quality image.
Yes. And so if you put glass on it, then if you put it on a copy stand, mm-hmm. naturally it's going to reflect.
There professionals who do this. There are ways around the reflection issue, depending on how you use different modeling lights that would be coming in at an angle as opposed to straight down. You wouldn't want to use a direct flash. This is unfortunately, I'm not an expert in reprographics.
Uh-huh.
I know about preparing materials for either being scanned or photographed, but the actual taking of the photographs is a whole different area of specialization, which isn't one that I'm intimately familiar with. But I do know that professionals who do this do have ways around that, because books are forever being digitized and photographed at this point, and there are many ways around that curvature of the gutter. One is by using glass. They use a non-reflective glass, and they use appropriate
yes.
light angles.
Yeah.
But another is there actually software programs out there that can actually, once you take the image and convert it to a digital file, can actually undo that curvature with the digital file.
I was afraid of that. Well, thank you for taking my call, Jennifer.
No problem.
Okay, thanks for the call. You know, speaking of digital techniques for imaging, someone was telling me about some research being done on scrolls
mm-hmm.
to actually scan the scrolls without even opening them. Do you know about this?
I don't, okay. actually. That sounds fascinating. I'm not sure how they have tiny little cameras, I guess, that must go around inside the scroll
yeah,
without opening
I don't
it.
Know.
That sounds fascinating.
I'll have to look into the details, because that's all I know about it.
Yeah, I don't know. But I know they're doing scanning of papyrus shards, though,
yeah.
and piecing that are scattered all around the world,
mm-hmm.
and scanning papyrus shards and then actually being able to piece together these ancient manuscripts that are scattered all around in all these different museums, and that's really fascinating work.
Well, and you know, of course, famously, Google is scanning books by the gazillions
oh, yes,
and so forth, and the University of Illinois Library is also involved in a similar, not with Google, but
mm-hmm.
with the Open Content
mm-hmm.
Alliance, to
mm-hmm.
scan books to basically create digital versions.
Correct, and we're focusing on unique or fairly unique, which I realize is a rather mm-hmm. redundant nothing is fairly unique.
Fairly
but,
unique.
but materials that are specific to Illinois that we feel have interest beyond just our walls, obviously, but for which there aren't lots of copies, and there certainly aren't any copies outside of the state, so that we can actually disseminate that information more broadly across the nation using digital technology.
Well, that's another whole story. We have lines all full, though, so let's continue on and take some more calls. We'll go next to someone in Urbana, line number 2. Good morning.
Hi, I have two questions. Mm-hmm. One is I have a rice paper Chinese seals, and somebody fixed with tape and got some glue of the tape. I don't know, you know, the kind of old Scotch tape.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything we can do about that? And can you talk a little bit about foxing? And I also have some old Chinese silk dresses, and I noticed that they're also getting a little bit yellow.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the best way to keep them?
Well, I'll talk about the rice paper first, and then Krista can take the silk dress. The rice paper is a very, very delicate paper, unfortunately, and to remove any old adhesive from that is really going to require professional skill. There are some great conservators in the Chicago area, in St. Louis, in Indianapolis. Unfortunately, we really don't have any professional private conservators here in the Urbana-Champaign area. But tape removal is tremendously complicated and really does use a series of different chemical approaches to be able to get it off safely without damaging the fiber structure of the paper. And with a delicate rice paper like that, that's particularly important. So I would recommend the American Institute of Conservation, the AIC, has a website that can allow you to actually search for conservators who would work on paper artifacts. So if you want to consult with somebody about the removal of that tape, I'd recommend you find a conservator through the AIC's website. As far as foxing, just to describe what foxing is very briefly, it's a complicated structure. For those who don't know what foxing is, paper in particular, but I think I've seen some on cloth as
yes,
well.
Yes, it does happen on cloth.
You get small rust-colored stains. They tend to be small dots, frequently star-ish shaped, so that you have a center point, and it radiates out in a circle pattern from there. Usually on paper, it tends to be around the edges and then work inward
towards the sheet, but sometimes it'll fox all over. Foxing is caused by one of two different processes, and it's impossible to tell the difference by just visually inspecting it. You really need to do microscopic investigation or try to culture it, because one of the reasons for foxing is actually a fungal infestation. It's generally a very non-aggressive one. Despite the fact that foxing sometimes looks really terrible, it doesn't spread to other materials. It tends to not increase in severity very rapidly. So it's not one of the fungal infestations that I would be very concerned about in a library. They tend to stay very static. Once the damage is done by foxing, it tends to pretty much stay at that level unless you get into a very humid environment again. The other reason for foxing is actually iron residue, and this frequently is one of the reasons in paper for foxing, is because when you make paper, it's obviously, maybe not obviously, but it's a water-based process. And if you're using water from a source that has a high iron content, you actually get iron buildup in your papers, and that iron will eventually start to rust, and that's one of the reasons that you see that characteristic brown shade. And there, with that, there's nothing you can do, and it doesn't spread. Once the iron is rusted, it's gone, it's changed chemically, and the damage has been done. To undo foxing really requires chemical bleaching, which is very aggressive. Generally in the library, we see foxing as just a sign of old age.
Yeah, we do too with textiles, and quite often it's usually in textiles. We do have some iron issues, but it's generally when the mold gets stressed out. So when it's about ready to reproduce or it's dying, it melanates. So what happens is it turns a darker color. So usually that means it's not an active infestation. So we can talk about that we carefully brush it off, mm-hmm. like we did before with the vacuum, with a HEPA filter and everything else like that. So we're very careful to make sure, you know, to look to see if it's spread to other areas. And usually in a textile, it tends to occur in garments where you'd have sweat or any kind of oil or food sometimes. So that's usually where it occurs in textiles. So in the groin area or in pockets, sometimes in the armpit areas, or where food would have maybe landed on a piece. So let's talk about your silk dress. Where is it yellowing?
Oh, it's kind of on the edges where it folds. It's also white.
Okay. Well, sometimes that happens. Silk is a pretty, it tends to, whiting, you know, white silk does tend to yellow sometimes. And do you have it folded right now, you just told me?
Yeah.
So you pretty much, you may not want to fold it. And it depends on how stable it is. Without seeing it, it's kind of hard to determine this. Sometimes it's better to hang a textile, especially if it's stable in the shoulders, instead of folding it, because folding stresses the fibers of the silk and actually creates problems later, and also creates little microclimates for things to get into it. So we want to be careful of that. And again, I encourage people not to wash their textiles. So the washing tends to change them. So it would involve a chemical treatment to not, you know, to stop the yellowing. But that, of course, should be done by a professional conservator. Again, what Jennifer and I tend to stress is preventative maintenance, really taking care of the pieces so that they don't have these problems, or when they do, stabilizing their environment as much as possible.
Thank you.
That gets to the calls. We have several people waiting. I want to ask just a follow-up question that somebody posed off the air about paper and about matting, and, you know, relates to the lamination issue.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people will take, you know, photographs or artwork, and, you know, it may have been something that's been sitting around, and they want to, you know, maybe, you know, put it in a frame and display it,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. I know there are different ways of going about that, and mm-hmm. there are perhaps some things to watch out for in terms
Certainly.
Of matting and what kinds of materials you
mm-hmm.
use. What would you tell people?
The first thing is to really talk to whoever's doing your matting and framing and make sure that they understand that you want a conservation quality mat. There are unfortunately a lot of people who do very cheap mat jobs out there, and they will use inexpensive materials that will degrade over time. And I cannot tell you the number of pieces that we have taken out of old window mats that exhibit what we call mat burn, which is where the window mat overlapped the art object. The window mat started to degrade and then left a big yellow square around the edge of the mat, so that when you remove the window from the front, you've got this yellow line around the edge of where the window mat touched the object. You want to use buffered high alpha cellulose or high rag content mat board. Alpha Rag Art Care is a really popular brand out there, and I know that a number of matters around here actually will use that if you ask for it. It is a little bit more expensive, but it's absolutely worth it. A conservation mat also will not mount
completely the object to the backing material. A lot of people like to dry mount materials. The problem with dry mounting is it's irreversible, and if you've dry mounted it to something that is not of good quality in particular, you've got a real problem. And I know Krista and I both have a lot of pieces in our collections that have unfortunately been dry mounted to poor quality mats that are very, very difficult to get out. So again, we're looking towards reversibility, being able to get the object out of the mat in the future. If you find out later that there are better materials out there or that you're having some kind of adverse reaction to the mat, you want to be able to easily remove your artifact from the mat. And so what you want to look for is hinges, preferably linen or tissue hinges, that can be easily cut to get your object out as opposed to mounting overall.
So basically, if it's important, if it's valuable, if it's important to you, spend a little bit more.
Spend the extra money. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Several callers waiting. We'll go next to someone in Champaign, line number 3. Good morning.
Hi. I have a doll that I would like to display, and it's very hard to find large display cubes. Is there a website that you know of or a catalog where I can look for the kind of display case I want to have? It doesn't have to be airtight or whatever, but do you know of any such website?
I'm not sure if Art Display Essentials, I like their pieces a lot. They have a lot of good doll stands in there. They may have some display cubes. You can also look online and see if they have, how large is the doll?
About 14 inches tall and about 6 or 7 inches wide.
I think that they may have what you're looking for.
And what is that called, ma'am?
Art Display Essentials.
Do you know where that is?
You could probably look it up online. And I don't have the number on me or the catalog right now, but if you'd like to email me, I'm happy to provide you with that list. They're not local, ma'am, but they will ship it to you, and their shipping costs tend to be pretty moderate.
Okay. It's called Art Display
Essentials,
and it is, do you do a Google search on that?
Yeah, I just did. And
Thank you, Jack.
Yeah, sure. The website is www.artdisplay.com.
www, and it's all one word,
yeah.
artdisplay.com.
Yeah, and looks like a pretty good site. They're in Columbia, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have purchased some of their materials, even for our own artifacts, and they work really well. They have a lot of book stands mm-hmm. that the library has used, I believe, and we use some of their stands there, and we've actually used some of their doll stands. We really like them.
Let me ask another quick question. Mm-hmm. Do you know of people in the area who do this conserving and mounting?
Of dolls in particular or just
no,
in general?
Of paper art.
There aren't any professional private conservators in the immediate area, unfortunately. I wish I could say there was.
Well, I'm thinking more of, I'm about to reframe some prints,
mm-hmm.
and they were reframed, 25, 30 years ago, and nobody knew about acid-free papers
right.
that I knew of.
Right.
And so who would I go to locally to get a really high-quality matting paper?
As far as I know, actually, all of the companies that do matting here in town can do a conservation-quality mat. All of them have access to the appropriate materials and know what that involves. It's just a matter of talking to them and making sure that you're asking for the right materials.
And it's called acid-free.
Acid-free, lignin-free.
How do you spell that word?
L-I-G. N-I-N. It's a contaminant in wood pulp paper that you want to make sure they've removed.
Okay.
And typically, really good quality mat board is going to have either a high alpha cellulose or high rag content. And that just means they're using very high quality paper or rag fibers. So they're not using really cheap paper pulp. They're using really good quality fibers.
Or high. The last one was?
Rag. R-A-G.
Rag. Okay. Fibers.
And I said Alpha Rag Art Care is a commercial brand that most people will carry.
Hope the caller will forgive me, but we have about 2 minutes left. We have someone patiently waiting in Chicago on line number 4. I'm going to squeeze them in before we run out of time. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Yes.
How do you get the brass or copper to get that very attractive shine to it, and how do you preserve that?
Okay, so what are we particularly looking at?
Well, I got a set of headlights from a Model T Ford. They're brass. And when they're polished, they're like a mirror, but they get dull in time.
Usually, there are some companies that will do specialized coatings. What that is an oxidation. So what's happening is the oxygen comes in contact with the metal, which pretty much then that's the process that happens, and you get this patination. Some people like it, or the coloring, some people don't. That's why people used to wax their cars. It prevents the oxygen from getting into those areas.
Right. So I can't buy any plastic spray or anything.
I really wouldn't do that because it's not reversible, and that's what we tend to be stressing. When we add plastics to things, they're not always stable, and maybe 10 years from now, it may look great now, but 10 years from now, that may actually accelerate the aging. Sometimes that seals in some of the problems, mm-hmm. and then it accelerates on the inside, and you can't get to it. I've had that problem happen to me before. Mm-hmm. So usually something that's like a wax is usually pretty reversible.
Yeah,
so
but that's time and time again.
Yeah, I know it is. And it's also not, you know, not touching it and that kind of thing. So.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you. We're just about out of time. I want to make sure we mention again the event this Saturday, free and open to the public, Heirlooms, Artifacts, and Family Treasures, a Preservation Emporium. And Krista, what do you hope that somebody's going to bring in to show to you?
Well, I hope that people are going to bring in some quilts and some interesting, I usually like interesting clothing, uniforms, that kind of thing. I get usually pretty excited about different clothing.
Okay. No couches or bureaus.
I would prefer not to have something that large. Okay. Something a little bit smaller would be great.
Okay, great. And what about you? What would you really love to have people, you know, talk about and bring?
I'd love to see some parchment and vellum. Yeah. I get really excited about parchment and vellum. That said, old photographic processes are always really interesting, too. And seeing old daguerreotypes from people's families is always really interesting. And hearing a bit of the stories, I'm certain we'll be pretty busy. So, you know, only hear so many stories. But it will be, I'm really excited about seeing some of that and hope that we don't see too much mold because that's unfortunately always a sad event.
Okay. And again, that is 11 to 3 this Saturday at the Spurlock Museum on the campus of the University of Illinois, just east of the Krannert Center for Performing Arts, 600 South Gregory, free and open to the public. Lots of people will be there, I imagine, so you should feel free to attend. And our guests, Jennifer Hain-Tepper, head of conservation at the University Library, and Krista D.C. Quinn, collections manager at the Spurlock Museum. Thanks so much.
Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.